Unfortunately, I need to leave you.
Okay.
But then I will join you for dinner.
For dinner.
I'm very
important
sorry,
stuff.
She got, that's right, exactly. She has a sense of priorities.
Yes.
Okay. Well, what I want to talk about here, I sent you a paper that in a way provides a pretext, but in light of what we were talking about this morning, let me kind of lay out where I'm coming from on this topic. I don't know, there might even be people in the room who think I'm a relativist. I'm not a relativist, but there are people who think this. But I want to distinguish relativism from several terms. We've already alluded to this, but I want to lay them out because one of them is particularly important to me. The first one I want to lay out is the one that I think has come out the most, which is relativism versus universalism. And there, this is I would take to be the kind of original notion of relativism. It's where you imagine there to be a well-bounded culture, geographically located, a kind of, you might even say, blood and soil kind of view, right? And things are true or false or appropriate or inappropriate vis-a-vis that. And it's a well-bounded space. And universalism is the denial of that view, basically saying that the way in which people ought to think, ought to know, ought to behave should be for all people regardless where they are. Okay, so that's relativism versus universalism. There are lots of different universalisms. They range from Christianity and Islam to capitalism and socialism. All of these are universalisms in their own way. And relativism is the opposite of that. And it seems to me that's a pretty clear notion of what the issue is about. And when we talk about I see you have Vestermark up there recently. Vestermark, who coins the term ethical relativity, this is what he's talking about. It's this dispute. And it's this dispute that it's the one that was very prominent in the philosophy of social sciences in the second half of the 20th century, typically using anthropological examples. And maybe somebody like Clifford Geertz represents the tail end of that tradition, because he's right on the verge of postmodernism, right? However, here I want to bring up a different distinction that in a way explodes this one, and that I would say is relativism versus constructivism. Okay? Because relativism, you got to take seriously the idea that relativism implies a boundary relative to the culture. So we can say X is relative to that because we know where, you know, X is and where Y is. There has to be some way of mapping it. But if you have a much more open space where there is, in principle, no boundaries, or that the boundaries need to be constructed, and they're sort of constructed as you go along, right, that's constructivism. Okay, so in a sense, when we start talking about the norms or whatever the people in the room say they are, right, that's constructivism, you might say, in a very degree zero sense. But it isn't really in the spirit of relativism, right? Because the relativists would say there's a right and wrong way of doing it, depending on where you are already. Right? So relativism has a kind of assumption of realism, you might say, built into it. Whereas constructivism is actually quite indeterminate. So if you can, you know, so in principle, you know, like with the logical positivists, they wanted to have a constructivist universalism. Right? In other words, a single language of science where all the scientists would get together and agree on one way of transacting business, basically. That is constructivist and it's universalist. Okay? And one of the things they didn't like was the relativism of disciplines. Right? Each discipline siloed with its own jargon, their own expertise. Because expertise, and I agree with the positivists on this, is a form of relativism. Expertise is relativism. You know, relative to a body of knowledge that's very clearly defined and you're either in it or out of it. And this is where Thomas Kuhn's views about paradigm become very useful. Because Thomas Kuhn talks about the scientific discipline as if it were some native culture, right? And that the most important process is acculturation, how you get into it. And that's where all the tacit knowledge and all the rest of it comes in, okay? So the positivists were exactly against this view. They were constructivist and universalist against a kind of relativism which they saw the knowledge system kind of devolving into through the proliferation of disciplines. Okay? So this is but we don't normally think about constructivism in the big sense, in the universalistic sense. We tend to think about constructivism in the much more micro sense. And that's where you start to see the blurring between relativism and constructivism, right, with ethnography and stuff like that. And so the methods, as it were, that were important in establishing relativism in the early 20th century are also largely the same methods that are involved with constructivism in the late 20th century and early 21st century. So there's a kind of a methodological continuity. And here, if you wanted to talk about a kind of breakpoint where the methods change in the direction to constructivism away from relativism, I would point to ethnomethodology. Ethnomethodology, if you, I don't know how familiar people are with the sociological history here, right? Ethnomethodology is a method very prominent in the science studies disciplines. It's the form of ethnography that science studies tends to do. It was started in the 1960s. Harold Garfinkel, Aaron Sicarel, people of that kind. And they basically held, it came out of phenomenology, actually, and Alfred Schutz and people like this. And Berger and Luckman, you know, the Berger fame who's been mentioned a few times here, he's in a way kind of part of this as well. And the idea here is that you operate on the assumption, right, that literally reality is socially constructed in that there is no fact of the matter about what society is until the people do it. Right? So it's a very processual, we might say nowadays, process-oriented kind of approach, right? And so ethnomethodology, in a way, the way it did its research was to kind of challenge the taken-for-grantedness of normative boundaries, okay? And in doing that, right, they weren't just challenging universalism, they were challenging relativism in the classical anthropological sense as well, because they were challenging the idea that there was any clear boundary between cultures. Right? And it's that aspect of constructivism that you get out of ethnomethodology, which then becomes the kind of signature postmodern attitude when it becomes generalized as a philosophy in the 1980s. Okay? So this is kind of, so you know, this is kind of where the history goes on that front. But I'm not actually talking about any of that. I'm talking about something else. But I thought that it would be useful to lay this out for you. I'm talking about the thing that in a sense, because in a sense, all of those forms of relativism that I've just been talking about are ones that I actually have relatively little sympathy for. So I like the fact that constructivism overtook relativism, and I like universalism over relativism in the first case. So I'm actually anti-relativist in both of those things. But here's one where I think I'm going to talk now about a distinction, a dichotomy, where relativism is interesting, at least to me. And this actually relates to the issue of relativization, okay? And this is where we're talking about relativism versus absolutism. Relativism versus absolutism, okay? And I see these two notions as complementary notions. In other words, you need to have, they're like two sides of the same coin. They're not. One doesn't negate the other. You need both. And I think the easiest way, I mean, for those of you who know something, you know, about the history of philosophy, that this kind of idea is perhaps most familiar if you know something like Hegel's philosophy of history, which in one sense, right, is absolutist in that there is an end to history and so forth. Okay? But what each event, how it figures in that ultimate end of history actually looks different as time goes on, so that what looks good or bad, as the case may be, at one moment in time, shifts its normative character over time as the larger picture becomes clearer. Okay? And so there's a kind of relativization of normative status that takes place over time. Okay? And so something that looks brilliant at the moment it's happening turns out to have been a long-term disaster, and vice versa. And we know, and we do make these kinds of judgments about historical cases, right? Short-term versus long-term is the way we normally think about it, but you can also say something that looks good from a micro standpoint doesn't look good from a macro standpoint, right? Law, you know, unintended consequences principle in economics and sociology. All of this is part of that kind of conception. And so, but this kind of notion of relativism requires, presupposes a kind of notion of absolutism as part of the mix. Now, where does this idea come from? Well, this is where we go back to theology, okay? As we always do, and this is, and it's appropriate with in this project, actually. And this comes to the topic that I think is the most important topic in the history of philosophy, theodicy, okay? Which is God's sense of justice. Why, you know, and the way it was put in theology originally, right, in the 17th and 18th century is, you know, if the world is so great, why do so many shit things happen? And in particular in my life, you know? And so it is about, you know, basically divine justification of evil and bad things that happen in the world. And this kind of attitude, which you know, theodicy is already there in St. Augustine, but it really becomes important in the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment as a way of rationalizing Christianity. And Leibniz wrote the very famous, the book with the name Theodicy in 1710, when this idea was kind of at its peak. And the idea here was, right, that, you know, that human beings actually have the capacity to imagine things from two different standpoints at once. One standpoint is actually God's standpoint, but we do that fallibly. We can adopt God's standpoint, but fallibly. Right, and that's the idea of trying to figure out where all this is heading, where all this is going, what's the ultimate ends of things. And that's a certain kind of knowledge which requires that we sort of look at the individual events that happen in the world, right, in a somewhat composite light. So in other words, you don't just evaluate events as they happen, as they are, but rather you try to put them in terms of a larger picture of where things are going to. Right, so in a sense you have to relativize their status, and your knowledge of that may change over time. So you have kind of the human standpoint from which you understand the events, but then you have this kind of imagined God standpoint, which is fallible, but which in a sense could get better, especially if you believe you're created in the image and likeness of God, which is a helpful notion in Christianity for these purposes. Okay? Now, historically, this idea, when it got secularized, it didn't just turn into Hegel. Hegel acknowledges this tradition, by the way, in his lectures on the philosophy of history. He knows about this. But it also is part of the moral philosophy we call utilitarianism. Okay? The greatest good for the greatest number. So that if you look at we think of Jeremy Bentham, right, in the early 19th century as the founder of utilitarianism. But he actually has precursors, especially with regard to the greatest good for the greatest number. Okay? And you find this, for example, in Joseph Priestley, the radical cleric, right, the chemist, right, from the late 18th century, but also you find it in William Paley, the man who's nowadays associated with intelligent design theory, okay? And intelligent design theory is, in a sense, a form of divine utilitarianism, okay? Everything's got its place, everything's got its function, right? And God is presented as a global optimizer. Seriously, no, seriously, right? And the point here is because God is creating in matter, not every individual bit can be perfect, but the whole is the best it could possibly be. So that means that at the parts, at the level of parts, at the level of organisms, at the level of events, there may be considerable imperfections. But those imperfections are necessary in order to get the perfect global picture. Okay? And this is where, there is this idea that things may not look so good on the surface, but they're really adding up to this larger thing. And so utilitarianism comes from this kind of tradition as well. Now, obviously, as we know from utilitarianism, this is a very relativizing kind of philosophy in certain ways. So that the value of human life, of an individual human life, is relative to the contribution it makes to some kind of greater welfare function. Depending on how you specify the welfare function, the life may be more or less valuable. Right? I mean, we've run across these arguments. Now, it's this kind of relativization, right, which I think is common to the Hegelian picture of the world, which the Marxists, of course, share, and to the utilitarian picture, both of which come back to theodicy, okay, as a form of theological understanding, that I think is an interesting form of relativism, okay? And I think is one that, in a sense, is one that is both very much compatible not only with certain kinds of, religious and ethical sensibilities, but also scientific sensibility as well. I mean, because one of the things that I think is very common to all the people who have held this kind of view is that they have believed in a very rationalistic scientific way of making sense of the value of things. Right? In the end of the day, the only mystery is our ignorance. And our ignorance will become clarified over time as we see how things play out. And we can get a better and better, as it were, sense of what God's calculus is. Okay? And so it's this kind of sense of relativization, which is the complement of absolutism, that I'd be wanting to develop.
Great.
Yeah, go ahead.
So you're saying that the value of a component depends on the value of the whole.
Okay. That's right. And the thing is, we don't know the value of the whole. And so as a result, our view of the value of the component will change over time.
And that's what I was going to add. I mean, that is just fine. I mean,
so there's a kind of hermeneutical thing going on between the part and the whole here.
We have a difference, too, between what we know at any given time and how it is. Because I'm not sure, but I take it you could argue, you might... So, I mean, add to your story that even though we, at a given time, don't really know what's going to happen, it's predetermined, or I mean, there is an answer to it. So in that sense, you could say that the value of the component remains the same, and in that sense, there is no relativism, but it's relativism in the sense for us.
Yes, yes, yeah, that's a very good point, and I think if you look at where, let's say, people like Priestley and Paley are coming from theologically, right, there is this Calvinist thing in the background. All right, which is kind of what you're alluding to, right? That there's a sense in which there's a kind of a, you know, there's a kind of Calvinist theology which would be realist on this, right? You know, and, you know, you see what I mean? So oh,
a child.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, sorry.
No problem, no problem. No, but you see what I mean? So the idea here would be that, yes, you know, God's already figured out what the role of everything is and what the point of everything is, and it's only, and we have to go through history to figure it out, but it's already been sorted out by God. And so what we're doing, in a sense, is we're learning how to read his mind better. And that's, in fact, that is, in fact, the theological genealogy of this view. It's true. And so, you know, if you follow the history of the notion of providence, the idea of providence that comes out of Calvinism and then becomes very much part of this kind of 18th century post-Newtonian kind of way of doing Christian theology, right? That's kind of where you get the transition from what he's talking about, which is kind of the original Calvinist origin, into this other kind of view, which eventually, you know, God falls out entirely from the picture.
Right, correct.
Sorry, could you clarify a bit more this complementarity? You have the... Yeah, I talked about relativism.
Yes.
But you have the absolutism.
Yeah, there's the absolutism is basically the divine plan or whatever the endpoint of history is. Right? And there's a sense in which, you know, that becomes clearer as we go through time and we learn more about things. So in a sense, you could start with the assumption that God's already got it figured out.
Yeah.
He's always had it figured out, right? He didn't need time to do it because he exists outside of time. But we as the temporal creatures have to actually go through history and we get a clearer and clearer view of what that is. And as we do, we also change our attitudes toward the particular events through which we live.
And that's the relativization.
Exactly, that's the relativization. So things that look really horrible 200 years ago might not look so bad once we start seeing some positive consequences, and vice versa.
But then when God dies, in this century or so...
When God dies?
If he dies.
My God!
You said
then you move into a different religion. No.
No, but you actually said so. I mean, you get the impression that...
Oh, well, when you get to Hegel, and you get to Hegel and Marx and people like that, right, you don't actually need God in a sense. The process becomes kind of self-defining, right?
But what happens to the absolutism then?
Well, the absolutism is still there, and this is where you start to get these kinds of, you know, Marxist fantasies of the communist utopia, right, being the heaven on earth, right? And so you're no longer talking about the moment at which you get to the transcendent point, but rather you're talking about the moment at which utopia becomes realized, and you literally have the heaven on earth.
So we construct the absolutism.
Well, I think this is what effectively happens when you get to Hegel and Marx and you move down the tradition.
Yeah.
And look, it's, you know, it's not only them, of course. You have actually some of the more heretical brands of Christianity pushing this. The Mormons, I think, would be the most obvious example that also have this kind of line playing out in the 19th century as well. Okay. But yes, that's what happens. Yeah. When God drops out. Yeah. Then the utopia becomes the heaven.
Well, what about utilitarian? Sorry. Utilitarianism. They wouldn't have the absolutism.
Well, it's... Well, I mean, you know, but it's not so clear, is it? I mean, I do think that when people do present the kind of nightmare, that sort of dystopia, like, let's say, Brave New World or something like that in the 20th century, right, those things are typically predicated on a kind of utilitarian view of the world, right? And when we start to get into these ideas that, you know, that in the long term it might be worthwhile to sacrifice 40% of the population to enable the 60% to really live well, so then in the long term we end up moving more progressively, right? That is very much utilitarian thinking, okay? And I think, you know, if you look at the way in which, you know, utilitarianism, one of its manifestations, of course, was with eugenics. You know, it did play into that. And of course, in the early days of the welfare state, right, all of that was part of the mix. Right? And even though the utopia wasn't something that was so clearly specified in advance, it wasn't, nevertheless, there were, this is the whole point of collecting indicators and charting progress. And, you know, we have this preoccupation in society still. The fact that we have to always be doing, you know, more, we're moving, we've got to get better, we got to progress, right? All of our indicators kind of push in that way. And there is some sort of imagined sense of there being a kind of utopia that we're heading to, it seems to me. You know, so even though God's dropped out of the picture, insofar as there's still this kind of forward momentum thinking with regard to society. Now, admittedly, postmodernism has killed a lot of that. I'm not going to deny, right? Postmodernism has killed a lot of that sensibility of the myth of progress. But that is kind of what we're talking about, where the myth of progress comes from.
Steve?
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking about my own chapter, stuff about the new atheism, and I see the same kind of thing. It's like it's that secular teleological narrative of progress and realization of utopia. So there's a Darwinistic vision where, you know, there are setbacks and there are violent events in history and so on, but ultimately things are getting better and we're proceeding to this end state, this perfect end state. So I wonder if this is just
The answer is yes, but this is where I think a lot of these guys aren't really pure Darwinists. Because if you were a pure Darwinist, you would have kind of the view of Stephen Jay Gould, who said if you replayed the tape of history, it would turn out differently, right? That there is no teleology, right? It's just a set of contingencies that evolution has turned out to be the way it is. If it had started a different way or moved in a different direction, we would never have been here.
Yeah, it's completely warped to fit an ideological vision.
Well, this is the thing. This is where I think guys like Dawkins are still drinking from this Kool-Aid that I'm talking about, right? They're still drinking from the progressive Kool-Aid, even though Darwin's theory of evolution doesn't really allow you to do that. Darwin's theory of evolution is a blind theory of evolution, right? It's only by accident that we're here, right, in a sense, and there's no great reason to think we're going to hang around very long or let alone improve ourselves in some way to take over the universe. Okay, but yet Dawkins does talk as if human beings could, and these new atheists are empowered by this, right? Because you have to think about where do these guys get an empowerment from the science they're talking about? Because if it's just what Darwin says, there isn't that kind of empowerment implied in Darwin. The only empowerment Darwin gives you is perhaps to overturn myths of religion, but it doesn't give you any positive empowerment in terms of your place in the universe. But yet they somehow have that, and that's because they're still trading on this older notion that comes from Christianity, actually.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going. You have Marxism, and you have evolutionism, and where do these all come from? Are these essentially religious narratives?
Karl Löwit. If you know, Karl Löwit, L-O-L-O-O with the umlaut, W-I-T-H. You must know, you're a historian, you must know. Right? Meaning in History, the book Meaning in History. He was one of the students of Heidegger. And it's basically an account of these kinds of teleological strains in history, starting from St. Augustine, who he believes really starts this way of thinking going, you know, through the Enlightenment and through Hegel, Marx. And the interesting thing is that he ends it in 1948, right after World War II, and he's trying to make the argument that this narrative may now be dead in light of World War II, and he cites people like Toynbee and Spengler with the kind of circular view of history that's the opposite of this, right? Because this is a very kind of linear, teleological, as opposed to a kind of cyclical view. Yeah, so Löwit actually kind of lays out the whole step-by-step how we get there. Yeah.
I get some vibes from George Herbert Mead in a sense, because I mean this is sort of kind of abstract generalized other than because I mean it's not that you only have your own perspective and God's point of view, you also have your wife's or your spouse's or,
yes.
I mean...
That's right.
And so, yeah.
That's right. Oh, by the way, one transition point that is in terms of how we get from the theological perspective to utilitarianism in its secular form, one concept that you want to look at with regard to somebody like Adam Smith, let's say, is the ideal spectator, the ideal observer, mm-hmm. right? As the person who is able to kind of give the place from which the moral judgment is delivered. Okay, that's the beginning of that secularization of the legislator's standpoint in Bentham.
Valerie?
Mm-hmm.
Just thinking about when you introduced this, you said two things. You said, well, you know, this classification of relativism versus absolutism, but they are complementary. So I think that's... And as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, where are we going to position these two? Is it relativism towards absolutism? Because I think what we put in the middle there will make a difference.
Yeah,
that's really, I mean, if you could stand above and look down or analyze it. That's what I was hearing.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I mean, the ideal way of thinking about it is the relativist position is constantly shifting through time as human beings are moving through time. But then there's this kind of absolute position, right, which you know may have already been there forever, a la God, right? Which everyone is, which all those different relativities are trying to get a understanding of.
Yeah. So it's more the however we want to say the processual or the moving towards, because I think that puts it in a different light.
Yeah.
Then I.
By the way, the reason why I think it's worth saying about why it's called absolutism. I mean, because I think that's always. It has to do with absolving, right? And the absolution, right? Getting rid of sin and getting rid of dirt is to get rid of the error that comes from the multiple relative perspectives, right? I mean, so the absolute perspective is the one that, as it were, preserves everything that is true in the relative perspective, but gets rid of all the stuff that's false that comes from its limitations, right? So it's like a dialectical synthesis. What Hegel, when he talks about the synthesis, right? What the synthesis does is sublation. In Hegel, right? That's what it's about, right? It's about getting rid of the stuff that's wrong or bad with this particular relative perspectives and then combining them in the right way so that you end up getting the truth, and that's the absolute. So that's how the metaphor is supposed to work.
So then in a sense you're absolved.
Yes, exactly. That's right. And that's why in the end you become purified and you go to heaven. And
that's fascinating.
Yeah, that's what you're supposed to, that's the image, yeah. So that's why it's called absolutism, right? Because you might say, why is it called that? Yeah.
And you have the follow-up.
Yeah.
So the other, I don't know if it's a question or what, but I'm wondering, when we talked this morning, it came up now also about this thing around ideology.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I, you know, if we were looking at any of these examples or even traditions, and how, I mean, the classic discussion around ideology, but from a functional, I'm thinking more from a psychosocial viewpoint, none of these, I'm trying to think of something that doesn't have an ideology. It's almost impossible to have that. So where, I'm thinking around this because it's almost like we may not define what we put around the beliefs in a functional meaning that whatever we hold at a particular time, but they do function psychologically
as
an ideology.
That's right.
And I'm thinking, so where's the, you know, I'm thinking about that in terms of like the examples that you're given and how we would deal with this. Also going back to this idea with, you know, the distinction between valuing science and then having science move to scientism, all the isms, where it's not so much this that there's no ideological components, but what happens in that? And I think that's also one of the questions we have kind of floating around.
Well, this is where, you know, in the classical theory of ideology, right, it is usually paired with a notion of false consciousness, which has to do with the way in which ideologies place limits on their own comprehension. So that, in a sense, they become tunnel visions, okay? And this could apply to scientism as well, where in a sense they kind of are not open to what lies beyond themselves. And this was something that in the Marxist tradition, you know, people were very self-conscious about, right? So that aspect, that kind of self-limiting notion of ideology, where relativism, as it were, turns out to be a problem, because you know you can't get to the next stage, as it were, of development. That's something that's been very much part of the theory of ideology, right? It's usually called the false consciousness approach.
Yeah, but the point is, I think what we're actually talking about, we are talking about ideologies,
yes,
less or more form, moving less or more towards isms, you know, I wanted to raise that because I hear that very definitely in the examples you're giving, and I think it comes back under, you know, at what point do we say this field of knowledge is not viable for answering those questions?
Why don't I let that one sit for a moment?
I may answer with one example there. quite an interesting example is the theory of electricity, or electromagnetism, with Faraday and Maxwell, both very, I think, concerned Presbyterians. And one could argue that, I mean, the very idea of making the theory the way Maxwell did it, from Faraday's experiments and his way of formulating the theory, is very much affected by his beliefs.
Right.
So you could argue, I think there are many examples of this, that these ideologies, or whatever you call them, beliefs, are indeed of great importance
sure.
in constructing these theories.
Sure.
But then you could ask, okay, can you undress the theory now and have it just as a kind of theoretical object which you can use for various things? Mm-hmm. Or do you have to, if you want to be realistic, also at least embrace some of the ideas behind the construction of the theory?
Right. That's a good... I mean, it's interesting you put it that way, because I think that is a very... from the standpoint of the way in which philosophers of science look at things these days, and certainly in the course of my career, that's exactly how they've looked at it, in terms of, in some sense, you want to see whether you can take the core theoretical idea away from the ideological context of origin. But I think in the tradition that I've been talking about, the impulse is a little different. It's actually to try to expand the horizons of the ideology. So in other words, this is why at the end of the day, Marxists believe you can only have a one-party society, right? Because as long as there are multiple ideologies, that means there's just lots of different partial conflicting viewpoints, and they somehow have to be brought together and synthesized in some fashion, right? So the idea would be always go for a more comprehensive worldview that encompasses what, let's say, Maxwell and Faraday already believe, but take it to the next level, okay? So that other views can be brought into it as part of the unified whole. I think that would be the direction in which this kind of tradition would go. Okay?
Yeah. Splendid. Well, I think you earned your place in the book.
I'm glad I got that on tape.